Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, entertainment, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your emails and calls. Before I go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So, I don't know about you, but that cup of wonderful coffee I had this morning is definitely kicking in. I want to start off with a rather long discussion that I promised you last week about the smart meters. Let's start out with, why has this really caught our imagination? And I think a lot of it is the creep out factor. And we have LBAM moth spraying, we have fluoride in the water, we have BPA in plastic water bottles. And those are examples of other things that over the years I've talked about. And there's a huge creep out factor that is, I think, psychologically based about something coming into our bodies without our permission and polluting our vital body fluids. In fact, I think I'm quoting from Dr. Strangelove there. Well, yeah, it's something that gets into our heads. It's a bit of a boogeyman. And what we're going to try to do in the next few minutes is deconstruct that fear and open up the box and actually take a look at it. So first of all, a couple of disclaimers. I really need a radio engineer to help explain these things about frequency modulation and amplitude and things like that that we're going to be getting into. I'm going to do my best, but understand, what did Bones used to say? I'm a physician, not an engineer. I'm a physician, not an engineer. And disclaimer number two, this really isn't a political discussion. It's not a debate, at least from my standpoint, about freedom of choice or eminent domain, or even for that matter, the environment, although I will touch on that last issue a little further on. And it's not a debate about whether or not smart meters work. And the concept or the promise of them is that they'll save energy. And actually, just to take a moment to discursively talk about that, yes, I do think that you could construct a feedback loop with smart meters that would actually alter people's behavior, that would provide them with information about their real-time usage, possibly help them identify times when they don't need to leave things on, possibly lead to the invention of automated devices, which turned off your computer when you went to work and turned it back on again and booted it up 15 minutes before you arrived home, such that from your standpoint, it was if it was always on. Those are the sorts of things that, with intelligent use of smart meters, which is an open question, could really help with the environment. Before we go any further, I want to spend some time talking about field strength and the inverse square law. This is an extremely important concept whenever you're talking about any kind of electromagnetic frequency energy, because it is key. It's just absolutely key. So I want you to imagine someone holding up a 4th of July sparkler, and that's our point source, and the little sparkles coming off of it, that's the radiation. Now, if you place your hand at 1 foot away from that sparkler, and you were able to count the number of sparkles hitting your hand, let's say that it was 20 sparkles per second that your hand was catching. Now, if you move your hand out another 12 inches, you've doubled it to 2 feet. But if you think about the fact that the radiation from that sparkler is going out in a big sphere, the area that your hand represents isn't half, it's actually a quarter or 2 squared. So the radius squared is the amount of attenuation or decrease in the strength. Come back another foot, now you're 3 feet away, and you're getting 1/9 of the amount of radiation that you were getting. So 1/9 of 20 sparks rather than half or a third of 20 sparks. So that means that whenever you look at this data and it says, 1 foot from a smart meter, the fact is if you're 3 feet away from that smart meter instead of 1 foot away from that emitting source, whatever that source may be, you're looking at 1/9 or almost a full order of magnitude less exposure, which comes to the PG&E website. The PG&E website also cites another report, which is from an entity called the CCST, and I'm looking for what that stands for, and I will find it, but I've got a lot of papers here on my desk. But anyway, this was a large think tank report that was commissioned by California State in order to look at the risks of smart meters. And just a few little bits of information. If you are 1 foot away from an electrical smart meter, you are getting 8.8 microwatts per centimeter. That's about the same as if you are 1 meter away from a microwave oven. And that's about the same if you are 1 meter away from a laptop. And I don't know about you, but I'm a lot closer to my laptop than 1 meter because my arms aren't that long. If you are in a cyber cafe, the ambient is about 2 to 5 meters from the Wi-Fi wireless router. If you have a cell phone at your head, you're looking at 3 times that amount, or about 30 microwatts per centimeter at a minimum. And it could actually go up much higher than that based on factors that I'd have to ask my non-existent radio engineer about. This is an important report. And the CCST report is what the PG&E points to as showing that radiation from these meters is trivial and not important for human health. And that's basically a direct quote. That's where Carl Murat comes in. He's the man who will be speaking at Loudon Nelson on August 3rd at 7 p.m. And I read his paper, which I thought was really a very, very good paper discussing a critique of this report. And among the points he makes is that all of the PG&E and CCST reports are looking at the thermal effects of radiation. And Carl Murat maintains in his review article that there is a lot of data that weaker electromagnetic fields are also having biological effects. And he cites a number of papers, some of which I read. It's an extremely well-referenced paper that he wrote. And we're going to post it on the website so that those who have an interest in the issue can actually take a look at those references. But just to abbreviate it, you can show that weak electromagnetic fields change calcium levels, removing it from the cell membrane, that it changes the calcium gradient inside and out of the cells, that it causes neurons to have a different firing rate of action potentials, which could be important. You can show that you alter the blood-brain barrier in animals, and I'm not quite sure how they demonstrated that. I haven't read that paper. You can show that cell membranes produce heat shock protein at quote-unquote non-thermal levels of electromagnetic fields, and you can show RNA activation, so increased levels of different messenger RNAs after you've passed cells in cell culture through these fields. And he also makes points that the estimates of exposure are probably too low because they're based on isolated smart meters. Well, what about your neighbors? What about if you're in the bedroom across from the 50 smart meters that are all looking at the people in the entire apartment building? And he talks about the additive effect of other radio frequency emitters, which I think is important. It's similar to the additive effect that you might see with biological estrogens, a low level of biological estrogen from the plastic, a low level of biological estrogen from your soy, and before you know it, you've got a level that might actually affect your hormones. And I think that's plausible. So in extension, I think this is also plausible. He also says that it neglects reflective surfaces and cites studies showing that, in fact, when you have a bunch of smart meters distributed or a bunch of RF emitters of any kind, including microwaves and Wi-Fis, that you develop these nodes of high exposure called hotspots. You know, this is physics. This is true. This will happen. You will get amplification. And that is not being looked at. Quite simply, it's a theoretical possibility, but no one is really measuring this, looking for those hotspots, looking for those resonance points of amplification and drawing a red line around them and saying, don't put the baby's bedroom there. The other issue that Carl Murat, I think, brings out very well is that most of what we've researched up until very recently has been continuous frequency. So it's just a buzz. Think of a drone. Think of static. Think of white noise. That's what a microwave is producing. But pulsed radio frequency is a signal. So it doesn't heat tissue, but it could effectively act like a cellular signal. And I think this is a real issue. Certain frequencies lead to calcium release in the membrane of the cell. Pulses and square waves are like Morse code. So it's not just heating up the tissue, but it might actually be affecting or disrupting the electrical signaling that is already going on. Now, I'm a acupuncturist as well as an MD, and I'll tell you, electrical signaling or electrical physiologic phenomenon definitely alter biological processes in ways that I exploit all the time. And there is absolutely a phenomenon that has taken place in the United States in the last 30 years in terms of the amount of radio frequency that we're exposed to. 30 years ago, we didn't have cell phone towers. 30 years ago, we didn't have Wi-Fi stations. We didn't have internet cafes. We didn't have cell phones. And so we have really increased our dose. And maybe we're getting close to an actual meaningful dose. So stay with me. We're getting into the actual data. Let me just start, before we go to the data, there's advantages to having cell phones. There's probably a lot of lives that have been altered by their use. We have freeways, so we have more roadkill. We have running water, but we've put it into lead pipes. So whether or not the net benefit here is enough to justify the risk depends on how much more RF I think we get into our environment. And maybe time to put the brakes on this. So here's the data. In this excellent review article, which I will also post, published in the journal Pathophysiology, rather obscure peer-reviewed journal, and authored by Alfonso Balmori, there is an extremely good review of electromagnetic pollution from cell phone towers. Now, when we're talking about cell phone towers, we're talking about very high doses of energy coming off of these towers. And he starts off talking about data looking at white stork populations in Spain and how the nests that are closer than 200 meters to cellular antennas don't do as well and have more eggs that don't hatch. He goes on to discuss data on house sparrows in England. There's also data, which I thought was very interesting, showing that EMF fields increase melatonin levels, alter melatonin levels in birds. And we know that melatonin and the light cycle, melatonin is produced by the brain in response to light. In the case of humans, that is our sleep-wake cycle. In the case of birds, it also has an extremely strong effect on their nesting behavior because the length of the days tells them when it's time to start mating. There are also some papers showing that they can be accumulated DNA errors and increased changes in the way cells commit suicide or undergo apoptosis. I've not reviewed those studies, but let's get to the meat of it. Dosing. So I found this particular study really persuasive because it wasn't using cells in glass. It wasn't using nesting behavior. It wasn't, you know, doing counts, which are very subjective. It was looking at behavior of real animals. And the doses that they were using are doses that would be something that we might actually encounter in a human biological system eventually. So they took the rats and they put them in a cage, and the cage had a Faraday region, in other words, a shielded area where the rats could go if they were uncomfortable with being outside the cage. And then they just counted the time when the radio frequency emitters were on, and they counted how much time the rats spent in the Faraday cage. And they showed also in mice that they could see individual variations, panics, disorientation, anxiety. I have trouble where you're scoring mouse anxiety in terms of, I think you can't double blind that. It's going to be really observer dependent. But I like, you know, how much time does the rat spend in the box? I think you can score that without observer bias entering in too much to it. They found that the dose of radiation, that the smallest dose of radiation that they could measure a behavioral disruption was 0.1 milliwatt per centimeter. And if you'll go back to those doses that I was talking about before, we were saying that if you were within 1 foot of a smart meter, you were going to get 10 milliwatts. Okay, so that's getting to the order of one order of magnitude difference. 0.1 milliwatt is 100 microwatts. So we're now within one order of magnitude. And we've already talked about the fact that these are additive and we have a lot more frequency, EF frequency emitting devices in our environments, the cell phone towers, our own cell phones. So yeah, we're getting to the point where there might be some biological specificity here. There is some pretty good data in pregnant rats. showing that 100 microwatts, again, we're getting within one order of magnitude, can cause miscarriage. And there's plausibility here because you can see that in a story we discussed last week, bioelectrical signaling is very important in early embryogenesis. So if you interfere with that signaling, you jam it effectively, inadvertently with an EMF field, you could affect the embryo. The embryo is going to be the canary in the coal mine here. And there is data on radio tract population. Who knew, right? You put a radio collar on an endangered species because you want to follow them and see what they're doing and see how they're reproducing. And by putting the radio collar on, you actually drop the fertility. And that's in the literature as well. That's an oops, unintended consequence. There's sufficient data, I think, to lead us to a couple of conclusions. First of all, I'm torn. I have an ecological versus an MD issue here. Because I think that probably a well-designed feedback loop, take a look at this month's Wired magazine for an excellent discussion about how technological-assisted feedback loops can alter behavior. I think it's true. Maybe we could get a 10% decrease in energy use from smart meters. That would help reduce fossil fuel use. That would slow global climate change. Maybe the health benefit of that for the overall population, you know, think dengue, et cetera, would more than offset the health damage of the smart meter. As far as the effects on fertility and birth defects, I do find this very possible, as I've said, and I have some suggestions for it. Another point that I haven't emphasized that I want to take a moment to talk about is just strong genetic variability. And all of the studies in the Balmori paper did note that, yes, there's biological variability. Some individuals in a population are much more vulnerable to this EMF radiation than others. Well, there, my friends, you have evolution at work. We have, yet again, changed our environment. And now, whenever you have environmental change, some individuals are winners, some individuals are losers. And some individuals won't even be born because their DNA is too vulnerable and they won't be part of the next generation. Not like the human race will die out, but we will alter that because we've created this new environmental situation. Ultimately, I don't think smart meters are the issue here. The genie for EMF, if there is one, is already out of the bottle. The EMF fields in most contemporary homes are already high enough that I think a smart meter isn't making a big difference except in very special circumstances, like the guy who sleeps with his head 1 foot away from the bank of smart meters. There you might have an issue. I don't like getting within one order of magnitude of any measurable biological effect. That's creeping me out. So some advice for all of those people out there who are listening and getting a little creeped out themselves. First of all, if you have Wi-Fi in your house, move it away from your bedroom. Move it as far away as possible from the places in your house where you spend the most time, which for most of us is the bedroom. Limit your cyber cafe use. Probably you don't want to spend your entire day sitting in a cyber cafe right next to their device. If you know where the hub is, get on the other side of the room from the hub. The inverse square law will protect you. And that's the thing here. If you have any take home at all, distance is good, just like a fire. Okay, fire is great in your house. You want to be, you know, 3 or 4 feet away from a roaring fire, not sitting on top of it. Cell phones. Okay, if you're female and you think you might get pregnant and keep the baby, maybe you should put your cell phone in the bathroom or at least on the opposite side of the bedroom to charge instead of right at your side. And probably you don't want to carry your cell phone at pelvis level during the day. Maybe you want to keep it, I don't know, I keep mine in my backpack. I figure that's a long way from my ovaries. And a decently long way from my brain, and I'm counting on the inverse square law to protect me. Don't sleep within 1 foot of a smart meter. If the smart meter's on the opposite side of the wall, move your bed. That's an easy one. Inverse square law protects you a lot. So take a deep breath and don't get too creeped out. I think there's lots of things you can do to lower your risk, but I do think that there's a lot of more important places we could be putting our focus than on smart meters. And let's go to our first caller, who's Frank in Salinas. Frank, you've been waiting patiently. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I think I called before about this, and I've tried a couple of different medications. The problem is that I sleep with sweatpants on, and heavy socks and the heat pad is what makes it possible for me to sleep. If I roll over and get away from the heat pad, my legs get painful, and if they're painful for a while, then they start jumping. I've tried Mirapex, and I've tried Requip from the doctors, and Valium will help a little bit, but if I just get away from that heat pad, the other thing that will help is if I get up, and I can't do this during the middle of the night very well because the neighbors complain, ride a bicycle, a stationary bicycle that I can ride, and that helps relieve the problem. You got any ideas as to...
Well, it sounds like pretty classic restless leg syndrome, just from your description. And the first thing, and hopefully you've already tried this, because it's sort of fundamental, is using magnesium. The higher doses of magnesium can give you diarrhea, so I often advise people to sneak up on themselves. Are you taking any blood pressure medicines or other drugs that affect the kidneys? It's a yes or no question.
Yes, I do.
Okay. So you need to talk with your healthcare professional about the use of magnesium, because diuretics definitely influence your kidneys and cause them actually to lose magnesium. But I can't give you specific medical advice over the air for your case, because you have a medical issue which may affect your ability to respond to this. So you need to check this with your doctor. But for the general population with leg cramping or restless legs, I start with fairly low levels of magnesium, 200 or 300 milligrams three times a day of a magnesium salt like magnesium glycinate, which usually doesn't cause diarrhea. And I have people increase their magnesium up to around 2,000 milligrams if they can tolerate it. And it's kind of to gut tolerance. The body's pretty smart. And if you give it magnesium and it doesn't need it, it'll just let you move it right on through and you'll get the runs. So it's a way of assessing that effect. But if you use one of these salts and you work up gradually, people can generally tolerate fairly high doses. And I find that it has a great benefit for calf cramping and also for restless legs. Some people have also advocated the use of MSM for restless legs, which is a B vitamin analog that can be found in health food stores. This is something that, if you haven't tried it, I would look into. Vitamin D is also important. Potassium is important, especially if you're on diuretics. So these are all natural things that can be out of whack, and when they are put back into balance, symptoms like restless leg syndrome improve.
Is there any kind of blood test that would be helpful?
No. You could try getting a red blood cell magnesium, but the problem is the range of normal on that includes a whole lot of people who are actually deficient. So it's going to be revised upwards at the point that enough research, the preponderance of research suggests that we change our levels. The way we arrive at normal levels is kind of a brute force method. We take everybody we test and we cut off 5% on either end, and then anything in the middle is normal, which is statistically true, but it doesn't necessarily mean healthy. So the normal range for magnesium is actually low from a health standpoint. So if you get a red blood cell magnesium and your doctor tells you it's normal, where you want to be is probably in the upper 75th percentile of the reference range for red blood cell magnesium. So you could look at it that way, but don't just be put off by your doctor saying, oh, well, that's normal, forget it, because the normals are wrong.
So magnesium is probably the most likely helpful.
That's where I'd start.
Uh-huh.
That's where I'd start, because that's just so basic.
Okay.
Magnesium and potassium, and if you're on drugs that affect the kidney, it's a good bet the drugs have thrown those ratios out of whack.
Yes.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's go to another caller, and that is Doug in Santa Cruz. Hello, Doug, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi. I'm good. How are you?
All right. I wanted to talk about the body internal thermostat.
Okay.
It seemed to me that there was something there, and now that I've gotten older, since I've turned 50, I noticed that my body's ability to adapt to temperature doesn't seem to be quite as strong. And I remember something with older relatives, where they had that as well. And I was wondering if you could tell me if there's anything that I could do for that, like my immune system. I can take astragalus and ginseng and ashwagandha, and it really helped. Is there anything that I could help that would help my temperature?
The first thing I would do is take a look at your hormone levels, testosterone, progesterone, and estrogen.
Those are all okay. I just had that done.
Okay. when you say they're all okay, you mean they're in the reference range, don't you?
They're within the reference range, and the doctor said that I am healthy, that there's no need for any kind of supplementation in that area.
Well, there may not be a need in the sense that you are hypogonadal to the point of pathology, but within that reference range, there are a lot of people who are not at their optimum place and are experiencing symptoms as a result. You know, I don't have your levels, and I'm not going to presume to second guess your doctor without even having the lab data in front of me. But given that you are coming to the doctor with a problem that you'd like to have solved, optimizing hormone levels, and that would include looking at your adrenal and your melatonin and your sleep cycle and all of that, is probably where the low-hanging fruit is in terms of helping you with your temperature regulation. So if you want to solve that problem, you may end up having to go to someone who has more experience in hormone balancing and do hormone balancing for 3 months and see if your temperature regulation problems disappear.
All right.
You know, that's like a no-brainer kind of thing to try. If you need to solve the problem, that's the question.
Do you remember what that's called? I took this in anatomy and physiology, and I remember that there was an actual, like, there's something like called Krause's bulbs, like for, you know, like pain reception. Isn't there a temperature reception?
I don't remember the name of the thermo sensors in the skin either, but I think the problem is more a hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis or HPA issues. The signaling there is being disrupted.
Okay, dokie.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I've got a couple of emails to read. This one I thought I had to throw out. Arlene in Houston writes, I went in for my yearly physical last week, and I specifically asked for a B12 test since I had heard you say there was an absorbency problem with proton pump inhibitors. I've used Nexium for several years. My doctor seemed dubious but consented to the test. All my other blood work came back normal, but I do, indeed, have a serious B12 deficiency. You were right. He suggested nasal spray or injections or very large oral doses. I remember your mention of sublingual B12. Do you have any specific brand to recommend, or do you concur with his suggestions for nasal spray or shots or oral B12? I look to you as the expert here, as I would never have had the test without your suggestion. Thanks for your wonderful program. If you want your email to be read on the air, folks, I have advice for you. Include in caps in the middle of the email, you were right, because my ego will definitely make me read it. But basically, to get to Arlene's question here, I think that shots can be good. The nasal spray is well absorbed, but it's more expensive. I'm waiting to see if the compounding pharmacists start coming up with nasal sprays, because I do think that's an interesting way to deliver B12. Under the tongue, something that melts under your tongue, gets into your bloodstream through those big veins under your tongue. And again, you can monitor levels. So whichever method you choose, I typically do use just store-bought sublingual B12 if people will suck on the lozenge, and check a blood level. If the blood levels are coming up, then you're on the right track and you're getting systemic absorption. The key is that acid is required for B12 absorption. So you could also take regular B12 with a hydrochloric acid pill, and those are available at health food stores. You replace the acid. You would also improve your calcium absorption, which if you've got a B12 deficiency and you're female, I'm worried about your bones, and I hope you had a bone scan, because calcium levels in the bloodstream do not reflect what's going on as far as calcium loss or failure to absorb calcium, which leads to calcium loss. Let's go to our next caller, and that is Nancy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Nancy. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
My question is about my thyroid. I have a good endocrinologist, and she's been watching some nodules on my thyroid for the last 4 years. We've been doing needle biopsies. They've all been negative. But there's a concern that the one lobe, the nodule on one lobe, has doubled in size in a year.
Mm-hmm.
It's twice the normal size on the left lobe.
Have you had a radioactive iodine uptake test?
Is there a short name for that?
Well, basically, it's a procedure where you would take oral radioactive iodine, and then you would have a radioactive count of your thyroid done with a kind of medical Geiger counter. So it would involve taking a pill and going to the hospital the next day. I don't think you'd forget about that test.
No, I haven't had that radioactive iodine uptake test.
If you've got an enlarging nodule, the question in my mind, assuming it's not a cyst but a nodule solid, is it putting out thyroid? Is it working? Is it functional? And in those cases, that nodule will gather the radioactive iodine avidly, and you will see it light up on the skin. Cancers don't do that. Mm-hmm. So that's called a hot nodule. And a hot nodule, as long as it doesn't produce so much thyroid that it makes you hyperthyroid, you can leave it in place. A cold nodule, which is one that doesn't produce any thyroid hormone, so it doesn't take up any of the iodine, which is the raw material for the thyroid hormone, will not light up on this test. And if that is growing, that worries me. That worries me that you've got a cancer, and despite needle biopsies, well, let me put it this way. Remember the old trick, stage magician trick, where they put the woman, usually a woman, in a basket, and then they take swords and they stick it through the basket?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, you can see if you use 12 swords, you're going to probably pierce the person somewhere. But if you're looking for tumor in a gland and you just do a couple of passes with a needle, you could miss the tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And what you'll get back is this core sample that says normal gland.
Yeah, apparently it's a 2-5% possibility of missing, according to what I've heard, of missing the cancer if there is cancer.
All right, so here's the situation. You're standing there doing a bungee jump, and the guy and the guy says, you know, there's a 19 out of 20 chance.
I love it.
There's a 19 out of 20 chance that the bungee won't break.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right.
You want to do it.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I don't like even 1%.
Yeah.
But I'll take 1%. But 5% chance of missing it with a growing nodule, I'm not so happy with that. Now, on the good side, thyroid cancers are generally slow growing and slow to metastasize.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not unreasonable to sit on it. But I think if it's a hot nodule, then you've got nothing to worry about. If it's a cold nodule, it needs to be monitored carefully, and I'd have a very low threshold for getting another biopsy, or two, or five.
And are you, since you're an acupuncturist and alternative medicine practitioner...
I'm bilingual, yeah.
Have you had any luck in working with people to reduce the size of the nodule through that method?
I would be very reluctant to take that on, personally.
Mm-hmm.
A goiter? Yeah, sure. Somebody who has a globally enlarged thyroid, but an isolated enlargement, I'd be concerned. I wouldn't treat an isolated mass of the ovary either with acupuncture. I'd be concerned for nothing else than for my medical legal neck in delaying therapy. And just to be honest, it's not just my medical legal neck. I'm talking about giving a patient advice that leads to them maybe having a death because their cancer spread.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I don't.
And if it had to be removed, and I've seen a surgeon, by the way, who doesn't feel it, we can wait, but we're going to do a ultrasound in a few weeks.
Yeah, I like that. It's not a difficult surgery. It's done a lot. It's a superficial structure. It's easy to get to. There's one important nerve that you have to be sure you don't cut. And so the consent's a little scary because it tells you you could be hoarse for life.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you could be, but the chances of them cutting the recurrent laryngeal nerve are very low. And obviously when they go to surgery school, they spend a lot of time learning how to locate and get that nerve out of the way before they start removing things.
Yeah, and he doesn't want to take only part of the thyroid out because there's a nodule on the other side as well. So he says, we don't want to have to go back in there. That's very difficult to do.
Exactly, because it scars down.
Yeah.
It's like putting glue in a telephone book and then trying to separate the pages.
Oh, good analogy. Okay. Well, thank you for your help. I'll check into this radioactive iodine uptake test.
Yes, please do.
And go from there.
All right.
Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Mary Gordeaux in El Paso, Texas, wrote me and wanted to know about her mom. And Mary, I wanted to just recap. My 87-year-old widowed mother has been told she needs a carotid endarterectomy on the left side, which is 80% clogged. The right side is only 25% clogged. Her cardiologist has referred us to a local surgeon. He says he believes a less invasive procedure would involve a stent. He doesn't believe surgeons in our town are experienced enough to do this and recommended it be done out of town. And she goes on to some other issues. 87-year-old and somewhat debilitated woman still living independently in the community is the situation here. And she has 80% clogging of her left carotid artery. Now, You don't have to operate on that. And I am just scratching my head about the surgeon's recommendation. Unless a person has had a TIA, that's a transient ischemic attack, you can make a very good argument for sitting on carotid stenosis up to 90 or even 100% if the other side is open. And the reason for this is that the carotid artery does have a bit of circulation in the center of the brain. It goes up to something called the circle of Willis, which is like a giant traffic circle at the base of your brain. And all roads lead down to the circle of Willis. So as long as you've got one feeder vessel, and in the case of this woman, she has three, or we can presume she has three because she's got two vertebral arteries. And the problem with doing either a stent or a carotid endarterectomy is that you cause strokes when you do that in a substantial percentage of the population. Back to the bungee jump, 3 to 5%. So you have a 1 in 30 to a 1 in 20 chance that the bungee is going to break when you jump. Would you take those odds? Well, you take those odds if you're having mini strokes. Yeah, you would, because the mini strokes are likely to go to a mega stroke. But to do it in an asymptomatic 87-year-old individual, well, the only reason that that's being suggested is because this is a well-insured individual who has both Medicare and TRICARE, and you're in a high utilization zone of the country. So I would take a deep breath. Don't worry that you need to rush this. And take a look at the national statistics for stroke rates on this quote-unquote less invasive stent procedure, because they aren't that promising. It doesn't really look to me like it's a slam dunk that we have to go operating on asymptomatic individuals. I would probably just take a blood thinner, maybe put her on some Plavix and a baby aspirin, which you indicated she's already had, and not do anything unless she had a TIA. Let's go to David in Santa Cruz. Hello, David. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. The bottom line question is, will a smart meter affect tinnitus in a bad way? It's a continuous signal. You can't shut it off. And Screener was saying that it's similar to sitting in a cyber cafe.
Yes, that's correct.
But you don't sit there, they say you're there an hour, but it's not 24/7.
Well, the thing is, in a cyber cafe, I'm glad you brought this up because I neglected this point. The smart meters only go on once an hour for a couple of seconds.
Oh.
So it really isn't.
Oh, okay.
So it's not a continuous thing. And the argument is, when it goes on, you know, for those couple of seconds, could it have a cell modulating effect? Could it be sending a cell signal that would have an effect on your calcium channels, change the way your neurons are working, change the way your DNA is doing? Obviously, in the case of an embryo, you might have an effect on signaling at a critical moment where, you know, it's do I turn right or do I turn left? And suddenly there's a big sign saying turn left, but that's the wrong signal. So you could see that sort of thing having a plausible biological effect. Tinnitus is actually caused by nerve damage. It's an effect of the brain's own biological wiring in that you amplify the signal from the damaged nerve. So when it's quiet, the tinnitus is worse. When it's louder and there's more background noise or stuff going on, the tinnitus tends to damp down because there's some, well, very similar to one of those automatic tape recorders with sound levels where when it's really quiet, the background noise goes up because the tape recorder is looking for a sound. Same thing happens in the brain.
Okay.
What I would say about your tinnitus is, for one thing, people often do really well with background noise or white noise or other kinds of sound if they can get it tuned correctly.
Headphones.
Yeah, exactly. So if you can tune it properly, you can actually exploit that brain functionality to turn down the level of tinnitus. And I want to throw out acupuncture because in my own personal practice, I have about a 50% success rate with tinnitus, which I need to publish. It's not a big enough N. It's maybe an N of 40 with 20 individuals responding. So, and it's hard to score tinnitus. And I doubt that I could get published in a peer-reviewed journal because I don't have the academic street cred. Maybe an acupuncture journal, but who reads those? So I haven't bothered to put together the data, but I will testify anecdotally, and that's the level of quality of information I'm delivering to you right here, that I have seen it improve tinnitus a lot. And so that's worth a try.
What about supplements? Not really.
I don't know. I haven't really researched supplements with tinnitus. If anyone out there has...
There was a scare article in one of the local papers about, here's the story, a woman didn't know they were installing smart meters in her apartment complex. She came home from a trip. She couldn't stay in the house. She had, the tones went off the scale. She couldn't sleep. She went out and slept in her van.
Okay, so this is a person who's already attended to sufferer.
Yes, and it was in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounded like, well, she didn't know. It's not like it was psychologically induced.
True.
So
she could be extraordinarily sensitive. I mean, there is a lot of biological variability.
Yes.
If I saw that individual in my practice, I'd probably start asking her about the Princess and the Pea phenomenon, and does she have other sorts of sensitivities? Does she flee from the perfume counter at the local department store? And there is definitely a subgroup of people who's, let's call it, they have immune system damage, which has led to chronic upregulation of their inflammatory response, and they do get tweaked by levels of things that the rest of us would just shake off. And so
now,
she may be one of those.
You said goes on how often?
It goes on like once an hour for a couple of seconds, and it sends its signal, and then it shuts off again.
Okay. So a cyber cafe would be more, that would be a good test.
A cyber cafe is kind of a cross between a microwave. There's always the continuous Wi-Fi signal, plus there's modulated signals going on, and multiple people are using that signal. So you've got the potential for amplification and resonance phenomenon getting started.
Yeah.
And like I said, the physics gets really complicated. I need a radio engineer or a, an acoustic physicist or whatever would be the appropriate sub-branch of physics to even help me calculate what would be the potential for this amplification. I mean, would it be, could you get 100-fold? Is it an order of magnitude? Could you get like nodes of 10 orders of magnitude? I have no idea about
that aspect. The reason I'm asking is once the smart meter, there's working on a way to not have it, but you have to pay for it. You have to pay not to have it. That's on the
table. And that gets into the political rights, freedom, eminent domain stuff that I vowed that I was going not to talk about.
Yeah, but what I mean is once it's in, meters in, it's too late. But from what you're saying, it shouldn't affect the internet.
Honey, it's too late. That horse done left the barn, okay? We got cell phone towers. We got Wi-Fis.
Yeah.
You know, open up your computer and search for Wi-Fi networks anywhere in Santa Cruz. And, there's 6 or 7 overlapping networks at any given spot that you can stand.
So you can't even find a place with it unless you go way out in the hills or something.
You know, I think it might not be unreasonable to build a Faraday cage around your bed. kind
okay,
of like
so
a little electric.
As you know, no effect from smart meters on tinnitus.
As far as I know.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're going to go to Marianne in Watsonville. Hello, Marianne.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I'm a teacher, and our school was had Wi-Fi installed a few years ago, and I haven't been using my laptop in the classroom. I've been using the plug-in desktop, but I'm probably going to have to start using the laptop this year. We got smart boards, which are really cool. But apparently they work better if you use your laptop. And I was just wondering, I really hadn't thought about the Wi-Fi before. I thought about the smart meters on my cell phone. But I'm there, 9 to 11 hours a day. The kids that go to after school are there 10 hours a day. And I think the whole school, the office, the library, all the classrooms have Wi-Fi. And one, I was wondering about the effect on the kids. And two, I was wondering if it matters whether or not I have the laptop turned on and I'm using it.
Okay, so let's do the math here. You're in a Wi-Fi field, so we'll give you 20 microwatts per centimeter for that. You're in that field. You've got a laptop turned on, so we'll give you another 10 for the laptop. Now we're up to 30. Cell phone use?
Yeah, I have my cell phone.
How,
in my pocket, and it's on vibrate because it's an emergency phone for my elderly mother.
Okay. So your cell phone is not on and it's not held up to your head. So the amount there is low compared to what would be if you were talking on it. Talking is like 30.
Yeah, I almost never talk on it.
But you're probably looking at 1 or 2 points for that. So let's put you at 33. Now, the most in rats, and this is a rat study, the minimum detectable biological behavioral thing they could see was at 100. So that's three times what you were talking about, and it's in rats. And most of the rats did not respond at 100. Most of them took 400 before there was a statistically significant effect. So now we're looking at another 4. So now we're 12x. So this is real rough mathematics, and it's non-quantitative, but just to give you a sense for, okay, am I getting into the area where we've got animal data that shows that you can affect biological systems? And I'd say that you're still within that safety zone of one order of magnitude. And what do you do about it? I think you'd try to shore up your system in other ways. Since a lot of this damage is oxidative stress, it would make sense to take antioxidants, eat a healthy diet, keep your stress level down otherwise, because this is effectively a stressor. Okay. Do what you can do to reduce your exposure to other antioxidants to try and compensate for this. And I think, seriously, I think physiological stress reduction, meditation, Tai Chi, Qigong, you know, there's such a smorgasbord of things available. But something like that, plus a good diet and nutritional program to shore up your system, has got to help. I'm just a great believer in the ability of a healthy biological system to deal with environmental stressors. As long as we don't keep ladling on the stressors and malnourish ourselves, I think most of us will survive this environmental change that we've created.
Well, and the students, I'm not sure how much organic antioxidant diet they have, and some of their lives are pretty stressful too, and
exactly.
They're littler.
And that brings up a lot of issues, because what data we have is in animals, and it definitely shows that the younger the animal, the worse the effects. And we see that with hormones and environmental pollutants and just about everything, infectious disease, I mean, you name it. So adults are stronger than children, which is kind of a no-brainer. What do we do about this as a society? Do we throw away the baby with the bathwater, so to speak, in terms of the benefits that we get from this technology? Or do we try to be judicious and sensible? And I want to emphasize that this is really preliminary data, and it's probably possible if we do find health effects down the line, such as if the signal is modulated at 100 cycles per second, then you get adverse effects on cell membranes. But if it's modulated at 50 or 200, you don't. Then we simply change the signaling that we're using and stay out of the range where there's resonance with biological tissues. So I really think that as we fine-tune this, we're going to find safe ways to do this. And right now, we're not there yet. We've got 10 or 15 years before we know how to build the smart meter that we can prove won't interact with biological tissue. Until then, we have to keep the dose low. And cell phones, guys, cell phones are the problem. Why don't we just take the cell phone out of the pocket of the children? Through the entire time they're in school, we just, you know, put them in the cloakroom in a little locked box that's shielded. The children are under direct observation from adults. They're not going to get into any trouble by not having their cell phone physically on them. The parents can get over themselves as far as being in constant contact with their children, which, by the way, I would say will reduce the parent stress level considerably once they get over it. We didn't always live this way. We don't need to keep living this way, and I think the cell phones have gotten to the toxic level.
Or maybe put in more plugs in the classroom to have laptops plug in instead of the Wi-Fi. Kind of a convenience factor, I think, for the Wi-Fi.
Well, once the Wi-Fi's on, the Wi-Fi's on. I don't think it matters whether you plug it into a wall. If you've got a laptop on and you're typing on it and there's a Wi-Fi going in the room, you've got your dose.
Okay.
It doesn't really matter whether the laptop's hooked into it or not.
But it sounds like the dose, even with the Wi-Fi, the laptop, and the cell phone, is still below what...
That's right. That's my message, is even with all of this, we're still, you know, an order of magnitude below where we see these biological effects. The problem is, are the biological effects we see, is that a real threshold, or is that just an artificial threshold based on what we can measure?
So I guess it's more will be revealed.
Oh, more will be revealed.
Okay.
Oh, my producer does say you can turn off the Wi-Fi at the laptop level. I'm not sure how much that reduces the EMF from the laptop. I can't tell from the data I have how that quantifies
it. Okay, so if I'm not using the laptop or the laptop is turned off, then
right.
even though the Wi-Fi is still in the ceiling.
You know, my engineer thinks that your idea of hardwiring is good. And I will throw out also for us Bluetooth users that if you have a hardwired device in your ear, you know, in other words, a wire going down to the cell phone, you've really significantly reduced your radiation dose. You've taken the cell phone inverse square law again. You've gotten the cell phone away from your brain, and you've done it in such a way that you're not producing more EMF with the Bluetooth.
Okay.
So a hardwired earplug is where I'm going now.
With a little wire instead of the gadget.
Yeah, I mean, people used to walk around with wires in their ear for transistor radios when I was a child. It's not a big deal.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I do think that when you take a deep breath, what I've found here in doing this research is, for the most part, reassuring to me that we're not in a toxic waste dump level of issue. And I look forward to seeing how this research plays out. And I also think it's a very interesting issue politically, but this is like the only not political show. Well, almost the only, because coming up in just a few minutes, we'll have Geek Speak. But we've come to another hour, and I need to tell you, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.